I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We hope you're enjoying your Labor Day, even if laboring. Of course, we'll have the latest news for you at the bottom of the hour, but we start with a break from that, a conversation with the great American songwriter Jimmy Webb. During his long career, he's the only artist to ever receive Grammy Awards for music, lyrics, and orchestration, becoming something of a ventriloquist. Performers opened their mouths, and his words and music pour out. Oh, my beautiful.
By the time I get to Phoenix, she'll be rising.
Our dreams of endless summer were just too grandiose. Adio. This morning I don't feel like driving in ye nails. You can have the floor, you can have a blast.
Someone left the cake out in the rain. I don't think that I can take it, 'cause it took so long to bake it, and I'll never have the recipe again. Oh, no.
But more recently, at 63 and still youthful, Jimmy Webb is singing his own songs.
I was a highwayman. Along the coach roads I did ride, with sword and pistol by my side. Many a young maid lost her baubles to my trade.
Jimmy Webb's new CD is called Just Across the River. It features duets with Jackson Browne, Billy Joel, Linda Ronstadt, Willie Nelson, and On Highwayman, Mark Knopfler. It's the first record Jimmy Webb has released in the U.S. since 1996, and he joins us from the studios of NPR in New York with more. Welcome.
Oh, my God, 1996.
No.
I'm ossifying.
Well, you know, let's start there, shall we? And, I mean, we're going to listen to this great new music, but let's go back first, because I want to make a personal observation, as you know. Right around then, in the late 90s, a local promoter here, Freddie Taylor, heard you'd sort of, you know, come out of semi-retirement with this new CD. You were singing. He brought you to his jazz club, Scullers, here in Boston. People in the know were flipping out, you know, the Jimmy Webb singing what are arguably some of the great American songs. And one couldn't help but observe, though, that, you know, especially by the second show, you didn't seem that happy and you didn't seem as comfortable as you feel now on this new CD. What's going on?
It was somewhere around then or shortly after that show that I decided to stop drinking for good. It made a big difference in my attitude towards performing. I have to admit that the first time I went on stage without a drink, that it was a little bit like jumping off of a cliff, because I had never done it before.
Never.
Never. So I think that that's been a big change in my life. I remember when I thought I was having trouble was that I had walked into the Wings one night to talk to my manager, Robin Siegel, and I said, wow, I said, show's going pretty good, huh? And the crowd was like up on their feet. And she said, yeah, it's a good show. And I said, how was Wichita Lineman? She said, real good. She said, both times.
Well, in fact, on one of your songs on the new CD, the main character, speaking from experience, warns against drinking away your sorrows. This is It Won't Bring Her Back. Let's just listen to a little of Jimmy Webb.
What you doing sitting here with closing time so near? Looks like you need a friend, so I will volunteer. Looks like you're in a world of trouble. Only one thing it could be. You gotta get a grip on it, mister. This is not the remedy. And it won't bring her back. And it won't stop the pain. And it won't make you feel any better soon. You keep a drinking that old Jack.
And Jimmy Webb, you say the producer, Fred Molin, took you back to where he felt your voice belonged. Which was where? Sitting around the kitchen table in Oklahoma.
Pretty much. He said, I want you to go back to your father playing his silver tone guitar and singing Red Sails in the Sunset, which was one of my dad's favorite tunes. Mm-hmm. We cut 13 tracks in 2 days, and it was one of the most wonderful things that I've ever been involved in.
Put the top down on this old Mustang. We'll buy us a bottle of wine. Head down south to see the old game. I wanna see some friends of mine. I wanna see some friends of mine. Good loving people whose hearts are kind. Find that little town that's in the back of my mind. Oh, Oklahoma nights, I will never forget you. Oh, Oklahoma, wind comes sweeping through the sky full of lights.
So Fred Mullen took you back to sort of the Oklahoma kitchen table, and you've got songs like Oklahoma Nights with Vince Gill. You write in the liner notes that the first time you heard him sing, you thought, well, if beauty could kill, then this would be a lethal dose.
Yes.
Even the liner notes sing. What does it mean in your music that you're from, you know, you grew up in Oklahoma?
It's a proud tradition, and I get a little chill when you say that, because it's a proud tradition of Woody Guthrie, Patti Page, Leon Russell, Barney Kessel, the great jazz guitarist, Chet Baker. And you say, well, that's a strange group of people. I mean, if all those people were on an airplane, you would think it would be an Irwin Allen movie or something. But they all come from Oklahoma. They share that one thing. It's a soulful twist of the soul. It's growing up on the land and growing up with a breed of individual who's proud, quick to give themselves to somebody else, and really, really pissed off and hurt when it doesn't work out. When you say Oklahoma, it's easy to dismiss as a backward sort of a place, but it's absolutely not. It's the opposite of that.
But it also is a place of space, and space shows up in some of your songs. I've got to talk about Wichita Lyman.
Great space. It's almost like being on the ocean. It's very much the same sense of boundlessness that you feel when you're out on a sailboat.
Well, and you hear that in Wichita Lineman. I've heard musicians like Pat Metheny, who recorded your Moon is a Harsh Mistress, say Wichita Lineman's one of the best American songs ever written. But then the other day, I heard someone say, and I just don't get it. And it occurred to me that this space and then this loneliness you were describing was before cell phones, before our underground cable.
Yeah.
What were you trying to describe in that song?
I saw the guy up on top of a telephone pole out in the panhandle of Oklahoma. You could see about 50 miles in that part of the country. So there's, as we were just discussing, this kind of limitless thing that it would be very difficult for you to understand if you came from a strictly like an urban environment. You just wouldn't get it. But I watched him go by, and I could see him up on a telephone pole talking on a telephone. And then I just watched him disappear into that vastness. It was the image rather than, it wasn't the lyrics of the song or anything. It was like a cinematic clip. It was a piece of film that just went into my memory bank.
Well, it seems, too, that even if you've never, you know, plugged a handheld old-fashioned phone into a telephone wire on a pole, that it also, it could as easily be about a cowboy out on the range, you know, moving cattle.
It's a cowboy song. He's a modern-day cowboy.
I am the lineman for the county, and I drive the main road, searching in the sun for another overload. I hear you singing in the wires. I
can hear you through the wine. And the Wichita lineman is still on the line. I know I need a small vacation, but it don't look like rain. And if it snows, that stretch down south won't ever stand the strain. And I need you more than want you, and I want you for all time. And the Wichita lineman is still on the line.
Billy Joel does Wichita lineman on the album. He loves that song. He deconstructed it one year at the Songwriters Hall of Fame to my intense mortification.
He sang the line, "Need you, I need you more than want you." That's a diss.
Yeah. And he said, "But I want you for all time." He said, "Well, geez, I guess he really does need her." You know, I mean, the audience was just laughing hysterically. But I was crying. A song does not want to be taken apart.
Well, but he was doing so when he presented you with the Johnny Mercer Award at the Songwriters Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I can't complain too
much.
No.
And in Singing Now on the CD, a song that was originally, you know, immortalized by Glenn Campbell, what does Billy Joel's voice bring to this song for you?
I think it's the sweetest I've ever heard Billy sing. I can tell when I hear someone singing whether they like what they're singing or not. Billy's like totally into it. It's so sweet. It's sweet and it's cute to me that he's really being sincere, because so much of his material is kind of ironic and sometimes a little angry.
He says it's about an ordinary man thinking extraordinary thoughts.
That's what he said the night of the Songwriters Hall of Fame, and that's when he got me, because I realized that he did understand. It's almost easier for a songwriter to think that no one understands and leave it at that. But when you realize that someone is getting it, it's a kind of terrible ecstatic pain, I guess.
And I need you more than I want you.
And I want you for all time.
Songwriter Jimmy Webb, his new CD is called Across the River. By the way, you can still tell us your favorite Jimmy Webb song at hereandnow.org. We're getting a lot of votes for this song, but also for The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, Art Garfunkel's cover of Skyrider, Jimmy Webb's soundtrack for The Last Unicorn, Ian Matthews' Met Her on a Plane, so many songs. More with Jimmy Webb after a break, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We'll have the latest news at the bottom of the half hour, but till then, we're talking with songwriter Jimmy Webb. His new CD, Just Across the River, features duets with just some of the artists who love his work. Of course, Glenn Campbell is one. He's recorded so many Webb songs, but Jimmy Webb says it was his producer, Fred Molin, who realized they'd never recorded together until this new CD.
By the time I get to Phoenix, she'll be rising. She'll find the note that I left hanging on her door. And she'll laugh when she reads the part that says I'm leaving. 'Cause I've left that girl so many times before.
By the time
I make Albuquerque, she'll be working. She'll probably stop at lunch and give me a call. But she'll just hear that phone keep on ringing off the wall. And that's all.
Jimmy Webb and Glenn Campbell on By the Time I Get to Phoenix from the new CD Just Across the River. Jimmy writes in the liner notes that he used to pray that God would let him grow up to be a songwriter and be lucky enough to have Glenn Campbell record one of his songs. So now, of course, he believes in God. And Jimmy, one of the many songs Glenn recorded was Galveston. But on your new CD, it's Lucinda Williams who sings it with you, a woman's voice. So how does that impact this song for you?
I think that Galveston was really always waiting for this interpretation. It was there right in front of me, but somehow or other I never saw it. When the album was in the planning stages, it just suddenly dawned on me that this is a two-character play. There's a guy far away from home. He cleans his gun. He dreams of Galveston. He dreams of this girl. But we don't ever hear from the girl. And it's a very simple twist of the, you change a couple of words and you have a part for the girls. You know, I still see him standing by the water, she sings with such passion, and you believe her. You mean, you believe that she's like a broken plate because, you know, this guy's missing from her life. So to me, it's like the song always had that hidden potential to be this great wrenching duet between a man and a woman.
Galveston, oh Galveston, I still hear your sea winds blowing. I still see her dark eyes glowing. She was 21 I left Galveston.
Galveston, oh Galveston, does he hear the sea waves crashing? Does he see
we're going to close with one of your biggest supporters, Linda Ronstadt, who beautifully recorded so many of your songs. And on the new CD, she and you together sing All I Know, which was originally a hit for Art Garfunkel. Just quick thoughts on Linda.
Linda is, she's my sis, you know, and we've gone through ups and downs, I would say, as brother and sister in our lives. But our musical feeling for one another has always been strong, and the affection that I have for her is really as though she was a member of my family. So when I saw her announcing her retirement, it was just like a tragedy. It just rained all day. It rained, you know, and then it rained all night, you know, and then I got up and it was still raining because I can't come to terms with the idea that Linda is really going to stop singing. So I told Freddie said, you know, we need to get Linda out of retirement. I said, Freddie, I don't even start with you on that because she doesn't feel right about singing, and I'm not going to ask her, so that's out. And he said, well, what do you think if I send her the track? And I said, if you send her the track with no comment whatsoever, I said, I won't complain. And a couple of days later, she emailed him and said, well, damn it, I have to try it. She went into the studio, and I think she turned in one of the most delicate, poignant, I would say, a high point in Linda's performing. So I think, I really do think she should reconsider that retirement thing.
That's Jimmy Webb. His new record is Just Across the River. Jimmy, thank you for speaking to us.
Thank you for having me back after all these years.
The ending always comes at last. Endings always come too fast. They come too fast, but they pass so slow. I love you, and that's all. It's all.
Still ahead today, packing up sleeping bags and wheelchairs at Camp Jabberwocky. Latest news is next, here and now. As we've been hearing in the news, today in Kabul, Afghanistan, hundreds of Afghans protested the Florida preacher, Terry Jones, who promises to burn Korans this weekend on the anniversary of 9/11. And today in Pakistan, officials report a suspected U.S. missile killed three militants in a region along that country's Afghan border. While earlier in the day, the Taliban claimed a suicide car bombing that killed 17, mostly Pakistani police, but also four children. Pakistani insurgents have carried out a series of attacks as floodwaters recede. Some of the deadliest have targeted the country's minority Shiite Muslims, but on Friday, the commander of the Pakistani Taliban warned of imminent attacks against the U.S. and Europe. Joining us from Islamabad is Roland Burke of the BBC. Roland, tell us more about today's attacks. We understand the attack was on a police station.
Yes, this attack took place in a town called Laki Marwat. Now, it's on the main road between Punjab, the largest and most prosperous province in Pakistan, and North and South Waziristan. Now, those are the places where the Pakistan army has launched offensives in the past against militants, and where those drone attacks, American drone attacks, are taking place on suspected militants. So Laki Marwat has been a target before. Today what happened was a suicide bomber rammed his car into the back of a police station in the town. On his way into that area, he also struck a school bus that was caught up in the explosion. Several children were killed. There was a large amount of rubble left. Cars were tossed onto their sides. The roof came down inside the police station. So police officers and bystanders were killed as well.
Well, what's the effect of the attacks? We know that these police were trying to organize people in the town to fight the militants, but this is a country that's also trying to recover from flooding. What's been the impact of the attacks?
Well, I think it just helps add to the instability. What's happened here is that after a lull, a relative lull in the violence during the worst of the flooding, the bombers are back. The 100 people in total killed last week. I think the explanation perhaps for this is that during the floods, it was difficult for everybody to get about in Pakistan. A large proportion of the country was underwater, roads washed away. As the floods have receded, people can move more easily, including militants. But I think the other issue here is that the security forces are really stretched. It's the army that's leading the recovery efforts here. And if they're handing out aid to the millions of people who need it and helping to rebuild bridges, then they're perhaps not quite got their guard up as much as they would normally against the militants. Although it has to be said that even before the floods, the militants were getting through often enough.
Well, then what about the Pakistan Taliban commander, Qari Masood's threat to attack the US and Europe? Any legitimacy seen there?
Well, certainly the Pakistani Taliban is getting more ambitious. For years, they've been trying to topple the government here in Pakistan. And now, as you say, last week, they are threatening imminent attacks very soon, they say, in the United States and Europe. To put that into context, the leader of the Pakistani Taliban was charged over a plot that killed seven CIA employees at an American base in Afghanistan last December. And the Pakistani Taliban was put on an American list of foreign terrorist organizations. So the statement that he made was in response to those steps being taken against the organization.
Well, meanwhile, as we say, the country still reeling from the flood. We understand the government trying to make up for a slow start in helping and recovering. What's going on?
Well, certainly the perception here amongst people is that the government has been incompetent at best and hasn't. And really the perception is that the government is not capable of really meeting a major crisis like this. People, when you talk to them in the streets here, say the army, though, has done a very good job. And it's really been the army that's been leading the efforts to try to rebuild and to get aid out to people. And really, I think in many countries, people would see the army as a sort of military arm of the government, and if the army was doing things, then they'd assume that the government was behind it and the government would get the credit. But that's not the case here. They're seen as, in a way, competing actors in the scene in Pakistan.
So, again, not good news for the Pakistan government.
No, I don't think it is good news for the Pakistan government. They've been severely weakened by the floods. What support they had has been severely weakened as well. And now they're facing this renewed threat from militants.
Roland Burke of the BBC in Islamabad. Roland, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, coming up, we'll go to Maine for one last fling with a lobster roll in 30 seconds, here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. Lobster. There are places in this country that are identified by one single food source, but Maine and lobster go hand in hand, like France and baguettes, or Italy and, well, Italian food. Lobster is a huge part of the Maine economy, and every summer millions of tourists head there to eat the famed Homerus americanus, or Maine lobster. And with lobster at $4.75 a pound and lobster rolls going for as much as $18, you may want to make your own. Our resident chef and Maine resident, Kathy Guntz, decided to find out more about the lobster industry and got some great cooking tips along the way. Kathy, good to see you. And the smell in here.
Good to see you, too. I feel like I should say, yup.
Yeah. She's got some lobster rolls here. It's just amazing. So, first of all, tell us, where'd you go? Who'd you meet? What'd they tell you about lobstering?
I went to Deer Isle, which is just below Acadia National Park. It's got a year-round population of around 2,400. But more than half the community in Deer Isle fishes or is involved in the lobstering business. And what I learned is that lobstering is very much alive. I was really lucky. I met a guy named Steve Robbins. He's a fifth-generation lobsterman. And I thought, let's start with the recipes and food. I asked him to tell me about his favorite lobster dish.
A friend of mine that I used to go fishing with, he was drunk about 95% of the time. And he was a very messy cook, but really good cooks are. So we picked out raw lobster tails. This is right aboard the boat. He made a homemade macaroni and cheese, and we took the raw lobster tail, and we laid them up over top of the macaroni and cheese and baked it in the oven. And it was the best thing I ever had in my entire life. Now, prior to that, because we hadn't eaten in like 3 days, so you could have ate a glove, and it would have tasted good. So
Kathy Guntz, is that our first tip? Cook lobsters while drunk?
I love this guy. I just love that story. I mean, the thing about Mainers is really good dry wit is abundant there.
Yeah, a maniac.
Maniacs.
Well, tell us some other stories that you heard from them, because the storytelling is key.
Well, a great guy that I met, Pearl Hardy. He's a fourth-generation lobsterman. He was born and raised on Deer Isle. This guy's been fishing pretty much since he was 9 years old when his father gave him a few traps and an outboard motor. I mean, imagine this little boy just putting around this island. He had fabulous stories to tell. Everybody's a storyteller up there. But one of the most amazing stories he told me was one day he caught a lobster by accident that was about to shed. This is the time of year where lobsters shed their shell, sort of like soft-shell crabs, and you get something called a soft-shell lobster, or what they call a shedder. So Pearl caught this lobster as it was about to shed, because they're usually hiding on the bottom of the ocean, and he tells the story about what he saw.
The back shell will split open, and then this lobster will flip its tail and stuff, and then the meat will start to come out of the tail shell. And then after, you know, a few minutes, it'll do it again. And then the tail will end up coming out. And then the claws are the last thing to work its way out. In fact, it's one thing that's kind of odd and really very funny to hard to understand, but a pretty good-sized claw, when he sheds, all comes out through that little knuckle right where it attaches to the lobster. In a way, you look at it and say, well, how can that happen? But, I mean, it does.
It's like a magician, the
it's
lobster.
It's an incredible story.
And those lobsters that shed, they form a softer shell.
Correct. It looks just like a lobster, but if you were to squeeze the shell, it would be soft, as opposed to in the winter months, you get a hard shell. And there's a big controversy about which is better. Pearl Hardy swears that the hard shell lobster meat is tougher. The soft shell lobsters are surrounded by a lot of seawater trapped within the shell. So you can imagine they shed the shell, the water's there, and then this new shell forms. So it's very protected, and it actually stays moister, and I prefer it too. They're wonderful to grill with, because if you put a soft shell lobster on a grill, the heat's able to penetrate the shell, and the lobster meat just cooks perfectly.
Yeah. Well, what about regulations, threats for lobstermen and women? What's the climate like?
Regulations are getting steeper and steeper. For instance, lobstermen used to be able to determine on their own how many traps they put in the water. 800 traps, no problem. Now the government's setting regulations. They're worried about overfishing. And these regulations have changed the life for lobstermen. So I asked Pearl Hardy how he felt about regulations. And, I said, are we overfishing? And he was emphatic about regulations.
There's a lot of regulations that they just push on us. They put the gill netters out of business, and then they put the ground fishermen out of business. And those guys are the ones that's telling us, you got to be careful because they're going to come after you next. Fortunately, lobstering is big enough in the state of Maine that it's a little harder for them to put us out because of, we're so big.
Well, there's that. Let's just get quickly to eating lobster. Now,
You've waited so long.
I've been patient. But let's address the huge controversy, because you once cooked the lobster live on this program.
Many years ago, indeed.
And people were mortified. It's one thing to talk about food, but then when you actually hear how it's prepared sometimes, and there was a lobster that was cooked live on the Today Show, and it caused this huge ruckus in the food world because it's said that lobsters are best cooked live. And there, are animal activists who are against that.
It's not that they're best cooked live. It's one of the very few things that must be alive. You can't eat a dead lobster. It's so controversial. I have read entire books and articles about it.
David Foster Wallace
exactly.
Wrote a well-known piece. He came to the conclusion that lobsters feel pain.
He did indeed. And, it's like we don't want to think about where our food comes from, and we don't want to think about the process, but the lobster insists that you deal with it.
Well, there's that. Okay. So put that aside and bring into the picture this beautiful plate of lobster roll. Now, if you can picture, it's almost like a Frankfurter roll.
The classic Maine lobster roll goes into a hot dog roll. This is fresh cooked lobster meat that I steamed. And you'll notice they're big chunks. This is a big problem with a lot of people's lobster roll. They chop it too finely, and you're like, wait, was that the lobster? So huge chunks of fresh lobster.
So you can really see. There's a claw there.
Tiny, tiny bit of mayonnaise. Just very lightly coated. And I add some lemon zest and lemon juice and a little bit of fresh chives. Now, this would not fly in down East Maine. They'd call this a yuppie roll.
Why?
Because the classic is nothing but lobster, mayonnaise, and a hot dog roll.
Yeah.
And you don't mess with the formula.
Okay, well, since no one can eat a lobster roll attractively, I'm going to wait to do that. But I know that we're going to have pictures and recipes at our website, hereandnow.org. Here Now's resident chef, Kathy Gunst, also a resident of Maine.
Correct.
Catching us up on lobsters and the beloved Deer Isle, Maine. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin. Enjoy your roll.
Mmm.
Good? You get the lemon?
Mm-mm. The lemon's great.
Yeah.
It's the night before the 4th of July at Camp Jabberwocky on Martha's Vineyard. And in a time-honored tradition, another counselor is being tried for some perceived infraction.
Who thinks she's guilty?
So, a pitcher of cold water is dumped on his head to the delight of campers who shout or writhe silently in their wheelchairs. Camp Jabberwocky, also known as the Martha's Vineyard Cerebral Palsy Camp, started in 1952. It now serves severely disabled children and adults across a spectrum of challenges on 14 rustic acres donated by the local Episcopal Church. The camp director is Juno Weavitt, Martez DeSlavey, fondly known as JoJo.
from your autistic who can't handle screaming noise and we're a very loud crowd to wheelchair quadriplegic who may need help with a bowel program. People who aspirate, who have to truly be watched when eating. We have a couple of people with actual G-tubes. It's a big spectrum.
This is Robin.
Hi.
This guest? Is Aunt Hannah.
Guest?
I'm a guest, yes.
Guest.
Dr. Steve, the volunteer camp doctor, introduces us to campers like Hannah, who speaks but also uses a soundboard.
Is Dr. Steve taking pictures?
Yes.
How's your family?
Okay. We've been better.
An understatement. Dr. Steve and Cynthia Gardner are the parents of Graham Gardner, a longtime camper who died suddenly this past spring. It's profoundly sad for the Gardners to come to camp, but impossible to stay away. Graham's spirit is here, and now so is his kayak. They've donated it for use by campers like Mary Beth Rush, a Nicole Kidman lookalike. We found her painting brush in mouth because her arms flail so wildly.
This is MB. MB, this is Robin.
Didn't I see her in the kayak?
Yeah.
I saw you
she
in the kayak.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
You were fantastic.
Oh, thank you. It was wonderful that Dr. Steve gave me the chance to try it out for my first time. It was amazing. I mean, just so cool to be in the water like that without my wheelchair and, like, paddle and stuff. I've always seen my mom and her friends always go in the kayaks, and I've always wondered, you know, what's it like? And it kind of makes you feel free.
Campers who can't even stand do kayak, swim, windsurf because of the counselors holding, carrying, encouraging them. Each is paired with a camper 24/7, working the entire summer for free.
I think any new counselor, you know, you read about us, you can look us up on the blog, and they see these pictures, and they, oh, this looks like it could be neat. But the first time that you walk into that main cabin to watch us eating and see the loudness and the craziness, it can be overwhelming. But once you get paired up with someone and you realize, oh, my God, I am taking care of this person. And you start thinking outside of yourself. That's hard, you know, for 16, 18, 19, just when they think they can't do anymore. Yes, you can. Come on, we can do this. We can get them toilet trained. Let's take them to the bathroom after every meal. You know, that piece, it's this epic family that occurs and this magic that is Jabberwocky.
All right, so tonight, it's almost 8 o'clock.
And that brings us to tomorrow's 4th of July parade. This year's camp costume theme, outer space. So campers and counselors and sequins and spray paint are scattered across campgrounds. Now, who do we have here? Who is this gentleman?
This is Rhino.
Yeah. Hi, Rhino.
Can you say hi?
Hi.
What are you going to be in the parade?
The sun.
Yeah.
That's
wrong. Yeah.
And then that yellow cloak-like thing on the rail, he's going to wear also that yellow cloak.
This is a big effort here.
Yes, it's a big deal.
Counselor Jacob has taken out the power tools to help fellow Counselor Dave.
Dave and his camper Dick are going to be the guys from Daft Punk.
What is this doing for you?
Well, I guess you'll probably see it tomorrow, but when you're rolling through the waspier sections of Eggertown and you've got people screaming and wheelchairs and bright colors everywhere, I grew up here. Everybody cheers for us. Like, I don't know, I guess a lot of these guys, like your camper Dick, I've been to his house. It's a nice place, like it's a nice facility, but there's not much going on. They have art classes and stuff, but even for me, like this is like really super intense. I guess fully inclusive, you could say. It's spectacular.
The morning of the 4th dawns with patriotic songs, and camp nurse Sully, also known as Christine Sullivan St. Damour, reading a column that camper Paul Remy just had published in the Vineyard Gazette.
I have been attending Camp Jabberwocky for 47 years.
Paul, who is nonverbal, listens from his wheelchair. He writes with eloquence about how in 1952, a speech therapist named Helen Lamb, known as Hellcat, brought 6 disabled kids to the Vineyard. They swam, rode horses.
They also played and talked with youngsters without disabilities, which was revolutionary at the time.
Now, Paul writes, campers make lifelong friends. They stay in touch through Facebook and are the highlight of the 4th of July parade.
Paul Remy is a freelance writer who lives in Fall River and contributes occasionally to the Gazette.
Who are you again?
Luke Skywalker.
Luke Skywalker. Chewbacca.
Yes.
How to describe the parade staging area at Edgartown High School floats from the Boys and Girls Clubs, the Rotary, the colorful Camp Jabberwocky bus, counselors, campers. Drummer Rick Bausman and friends will lead the Jabberwocky contingent. And there's a surprise. Founder Helen Lamb, some 96 years old. I remark on how far her vision for the disabled has come, but she's not satisfied.
I have been into many houses, and even today, they have a special room for them, and they spend mornings, afternoons, evenings, nights in that room. And that's what I used to want to stop.
What do you want people to know about Camp Jabberwocky as we leave?
Keep on growing.
I understand you start camp every year with your rendition of the poem Jabberwocky. Can you just start us off?
"'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy where the borogoves and the mome raths outgrabe."
Excuse me, I know we've got we're wheeling Princess Leia here, but I'm just wondering, as a counselor, what is this like?
It's incredible.
Now, can you tell if your camper's having a good time?
Look at her! Yeah, she's having a great time.
Hey, Hillary!
Hey, Hillary! Yay!
Do you have camper or counselor?
Camper. Hillary Rustin.
Oh, she's beautiful.
She looked amazing.
What's it like to have a camper in this parade?
It's just amazing, you know, it just brings tears to your eyes, so.
It's about making your camper shine on this day. When Helen started this, it was about getting kids out of the basement, hidden. And then when you see a young counselor taking care of them, a lot of people think they're family, and then they realize, oh, this is a kid who volunteered their entire summer to go and take care of someone with a disability. Like, eyes start to open, I think. We're going to be seen.
I get tears in my eyes. It's my favorite part of the parade for many years. And they used to start out always in the bus. Now nearly everybody is outside. Fabulous.
So on this Labor Day, we leave you with one of our favorite moments from this past summer, a real Independence Day. For more on Camp Jabberwocky on the Massachusetts island of Martha's Vineyard, go to hereandnow.org. This story is dedicated to the memory of camper Graham Gardner. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.